This is the Coaches Rising podcast. Welcome back. Today I'm joined by Charlie Aubrey, and Charlie is someone whose work had a real positive and powerful impact on me. Charlie is a guide for leaders at the limits of conventional thinking. They are a developmental coach and contemplative teacher, and their practice integrates adult stage development theory with Vajrayana Buddhist meditation. Charlie works with clients at the forefront of AI development and AI company founders, researchers at DeepMind, Anthropic, and academics whose work is reshaping our understanding of mind and cognition. So we're going to be exploring today, what is Charlie doing with their clients? How does the Vajrayana view and developmental view influence their work? For me, the Vajrayana view has been very powerful because it has a different emphasis than what many of the views in the current spiritual landscape espouse, which can be more renunciate and transcendent. The Vajrayana view is really about being here. It's about ways of being. It's about working with the patterning of the moment and enjoying life, being fully engaged. And I think there's many parallels to coaching for me. So I've been really excited to get Charlie on the podcast for a long time. We'll explore today, what is the Vajrayana view? We'll talk about practice, working with emotions, the Vajrayana view of the self, and what happens when Charlie enters what they call the real conversation with their clients. A few more words about Charlie. Charlie co-founded Evolving Ground, a practice community exploring the integration of embodied awareness and psychological development with meaningful work and play. Their work is informed by a multidisciplinary background, anthropology, economics, and international development. And they are the author of Opening Awareness. It's a fantastic meditation guide, which points to a meditation practice which fits with the Vajrayana view as opposed to maybe some more renunciate meditation practices. All right, I said a lot. Let's actually dive in right now. Here's the podcast with Charlie Aubrey. I don't have to tell you that these are turbulent times. They're astonishing times. Many people are feeling deeply challenged, more reactive, and my sense is in more need of coaching than ever. And while these times are full of challenges, they're also ripe with evolutionary potential. This is the gift of these times. And I think it's these moments that coaches are built for. So we can help our clients unlock the deeper capacities and intelligence that's required of them now. And that's exactly what our newest program, Unlocking Leaders, is all about. You'll learn how to work at the source code of change, beyond strategy, beyond protocol, at the level of consciousness itself. This, for me, has been by far the biggest leverage I have with my clients. It's the most potent move I can make, because the level of consciousness a leader is operating from determines everything. What they notice, what they miss, whether they react defensively, stay grounded, whether they tighten in control or open into creativity and collaborativity, and ultimately what becomes possible in how they lead. And when you work at this level, you'll be able to tap into these hidden drivers behind decisions and behaviors and unlock possibilities in situations that once felt stuck. And beyond that, importantly, you're going to cultivate a capacity that AI will never possess. As AI expands and begins to dominate procedural and operational coaching, as it grows, it's becoming clearer what it cannot do. And it can't feel, it can't connect in the same way when two human beings come together and the field that they create becomes part of the transformational conversation. It can't work with consciousness, the very source of transformation and the source of the most powerful coaching moves. This is what separates good coaches from great coaches working at this level. And AI can't touch this. So if you're interested to find out more about this program, if you feel called to join us, then head to coachesrising.com/leaders to book your spot. The first class is June 16th with Jim Dethmer, just an incredible, masterful coach. And he's joined by Bob Anderson, also a true pioneer in the field of conscious leadership and coaching. And if you sign up by May 29th, you can get the early bird discount. Enrollment is open until June 12th. So head to coachesrising.com/leaders to book your spot. So Charlie, it's a delight to be with you. And I'm going to ask you how you are in a moment, but I actually want to express my gratitude first for your work. You're writing about, well, many things, I think, but one of the things is a Vajrayana view of Buddhism. And you know, your writing really was impactful for me when I was coming through a very difficult transition out of a more sutric view of spiritual practice and renunciate practice, which I think we're going to get into in more detail at points in our conversation today. But I really recommend people to read what you write, because I think that information isn't necessarily so well known or prevalent in the spiritual world. So thank you, first of all, for writing that.
Well, thank you. That means a lot to me to hear you say that, Joel. I really appreciate you bringing that. Yeah, because, you know, the process of writing, like you write something that feels really heartfelt or that is reflective of personal experience. And there's a way in which you just don't know in terms of the communication how that's going to land or where it's going to land or what's going to happen with that. And so it's lovely to hear you mention that and to have feedback. And I'm glad, I'm really glad that when you had that experience yourself, and I remember talking with you a few years ago about all of that soul searching and that that wandering and your journey. Yeah, that it's good to know that you can have support, that you can have challenge, that you can have writing from others who've been through that same process. So
yeah
I'm glad.
Yeah, I think it points to an important topic, like I just mentioned. I think we'll get into more. How are you doing, first of all, as well?
I'm really good. Thank you for the question. I am. I'll share a little bit of my context to ground us here. I'm in London. Usually, I'm in America, but I landed in London 4 days ago, so my body has caught up with being hurtled through the skies. And so I look out of my window and there's bluebells in the little park opposite. I'm in a hotel room and it's sunny and just, I love that. I love the bluebells in Britain and I love this area, lovely big old trees in this area of London that I've landed in. So yeah, I'm feeling very good. I feel kind of warmth in my heart, my central channel. Spacious here with you. Yeah. How are you?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a lot of excitement coming into this call because of the excitement I have for this kind of convergence of coaching and Vajrayana practice and developmental psychology, gestalt work that I know you have in your work. And so there's excitement. And I these days I notice I feel really inspired a lot. It's kind of like been a default setting, and it seems kind of unreasonable in some ways, considering what's unfolding in the world. But I find myself just often quite astonished by the world.
Yeah. Me too. And it's as soon as you become localized and connected and in conversation with people that inspiration occurs, I find. It's as soon as we get concrete and contextual to what is our shared interest and purpose here. What are we curious about? What are we bringing into being, co-creating? And then there's less doomsdaying and more pragmatism and practical orientation to what we can actually do and create. That inspires me. Yeah.
I think you're pointing actually to me to one of the key invitations, I feel that, yeah, because you can feel overwhelmed if I watch the news and, you know, I see the enormity of everything unfolding, but this that you described there, coming into connection with others and relating around our passion and what excites us, and there's a sense of agency and grounding that can come online. It feels very, very needed, you know. And actually, I think maybe this segues into some of the things you're naming there, I think, are why I liked how you wrote about Vajrayana practice, you know, that it is relational and it's contextual. And because I think in the leadership industry and in spiritual circles, there's a tendency to maybe decontextualize a self, you know, to atomize the leader, disconnect it from the system or the context. And I wonder if you could say, you know, before we get more detailed into some of the ideas, could you tell us a little bit about the work you do, your coaching leaders, executives, and so could you tell us a little bit about that and why, you know, Vajrayana, developmental psychology, et cetera, is you find so valuable in doing that kind of coaching with those people?
That's a great question. I think I want to start with my clients, actually. They are deeply, deeply curious, caring, interested and interesting human beings. They're very diverse. They have families, they have children, they are full of emotional capacity and intelligence and competence. They're smart. I'm thinking about what is the connecting thread here between all of my clients, and it is that curiosity, and it's that they share a lifelong passion in understanding perception, understanding, trying to understand consciousness, the mind, what even is a mind, or our embodied mind, how do we relate with each other and our experience. And so they're engineers, they're scientists, they're nearly all AI researchers, some in finance, many exited startup founders, but for the most part, academics and researchers who are at the heart of the unfolding relationship with AI. And they are also meditators. They're not simply interested in the empirical or the computational or the linguistic movements of AI and how we relate to those. They're interested from their own phenomenological, from their subjective, experiential perspective. They're lifelong, long-term meditators, some very, very advanced in their practice, have been meditating for decades. And so they're, you know, I think sometimes there's this this image of the very influential, successful, driven, unconscientious, powerful person who is taking the world into a kind of potential doomsday scenario. And my experience with people who are in those positions of responsibility and power and influence is that they're deeply, deeply caring and concerned. They have children, they have families, they want the best from this extraordinary, extraordinary place that we've got to in the history of human development. And so where my conversations with them occur and the emergence of what is happening in the coaching relationship there is, it is this confluence of interest in what is happening psychologically, emotionally, and how that impacts one's work, and how do we bring our understanding from sitting, from meditation, from various different frameworks and scientific frameworks as well, and bring those together in conversation into a place of creating and maybe modeling different futures or modeling what can happen in terms of behavior or what can happen, what might happen socially or individually as we develop our relationships with AI. What does it even mean to have a human AI relationship? I mean, it's fascinating. It really is. Yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting because I knew you worked with people in that field, but I didn't expect our conversation to go here. And the question that bubbles up is, and I've not thought about this, but it's one of the things we've talked about on the podcast is, what role do coaches play, if any, in when working with influential leaders? In, I don't know what the role is. Is it being a provocateur or stimulating people to think more deeply or widely about the impact and consequences of something like AI? Peter Hawkins said, what were coaches doing in the 2008 banking crisis? And the joke is like they were all putting their invoices in quickly, And he was kind of making a point of like, well, yeah, all these bankers were being coached, and therefore, what's the role of coaching if it didn't prevent something like that? Which is, a very nuanced inquiry. But I wonder what comes up for you around that. It's great to hear you say that these people are actually, very loving, conscientious people, because they can be portrayed in the media not like that.
As not human.
Exactly, yeah. Right.
Mm.
Yeah, so I don't know if there's a specific question in there, but I mean, I guess the question is about how you perceive your role in terms of, like, is there a moral impulse to provoke and look at that wider perspective with clients?
I think that happens naturally. I mean, you can't be in that context and working in that context and not have those kinds of questions and concerns as well. There's, just before we started our conversation, we were in that area of bringing everything into context and localizing and being like in the affordances of what do we actually have here now. And often I find my role being to facilitate that, to come from not necessarily to ignore the abstract or the general, but to facilitate the movement from the abstract, from very much a kind of mental model into, well, hang on a minute. When you say that, what's happening? What's happening in your body? If we come into presence here together, if we come into the context, what matters about that? And notice what's happening as we slow down in this conversation. So a lot of my work starts And I think my role is in the beginning to facilitate coming right into the embodied, real-time, immediate, visceral experience of being together. And the more that that becomes possible, the more that my clients take that into their lives, into their work situations, into their team contexts, and they're able to be present, like really be present with what is impacting the choices and the decisions and the next steps in creating models.
Yeah. This is where I think maybe the question of Vajrayana and developmental psychology comes in for me, because I feel like in our times, probably this is always a very relevant and potent practice, but it seems like with the perturbance of the world, there's more need, or maybe it's just louder for people that there's, you know, the conditions are kind of very active and it's inviting us to into more attunement with our embodied experience. And could you say something here about, because this is why I think Vajrayana, if I say what I think, and then that it's working with the energy of the context we find ourselves in. And what I liked about what you wrote when I found you is that, you know, there's a renunciate path of spirituality, which can kind of focus a lot on no self. And then, but Vajrayana has a different focus, which is, you know, it kind of points to more like our relationality to experience. And I even saw you using this phrase, ways of being. And I was like, wow, that's like in you know, our kind of coaching field, ways of being, like ontological territory. Like, so, you know, could you say what Vajrayana is? And we can even start tying it to developmental psychology in a bit, and how you feel it's relevant for this work you just described, right, with your clients of presence.
Let's do that. I'm just thinking, you know, we're here with our listeners, and it may be a new word, Vajrayana. It's one of those kind of Buddhist-y jargony words, isn't it? So what's a good way to introduce this? How about we start? How about I could just say some words, and I'm going to invite you and our listener to, as I'm saying these words, maybe just, you know, center, take a deep breath, and just see, feel, right? Notice and experience what happens in your body when I say these words. I don't want it. Get rid of it. Ugh. This is not me. Put it over there. Distance. Get away from it. I don't like. I don't want. Ew. I'm going to introduce some more words, some more. See, stay with what happens, like inside your skin. Connection. Engagement. Being with. Together, feelings, emotions, stepping towards spacious connection, being in this with, there is no escape. This is it. Here we are. What is possible? What can come out of this? What can come from this? Who are we? How is this here? Not there, here. Those were somewhat polarized, you know, it's a little bit fabricated. Obviously I was leaning right into the end, the range of renunciative practice that is very much, or has been historically very much about getting somewhere else, getting away from this world, finding something different by renouncing. So very much a dualist path. And that is what we might refer to as the most hardcore renunciative tradition. We'll have that kind of attitude, and it's an attitude, it's a resistance. It's like you can feel the texture of that resistance towards whatever it is, towards getting up in the morning. If you're in that experience, resisting, moving away, then you could understand that as being in a renunciative frame. Now, there's a positive relationship with renunciation as well, which is the positive aspect of being able to untangle, being able to separate, really important in developmental psychology, to individuate, to know difference, to have space, to be able to see clearly, so to cultivate or to find the possibility for space in relationship and difference. So, you know, renunciation has a whole range, a whole nuanced range of possibility. It's not all bad at all. Vajrayana, so Vajrayana, the path of huge, indestructible capacity, competence, activity in the world, effectiveness in the world. So it's very much in and of this world. It has a worldly orientation, a very pragmatic orientation. It is not about rejecting. It's about transforming through connection. And like you said earlier, Joel, everything in Vajrayana is oriented towards interaction, towards relationship, towards connecting. And ultimately, in the path of Tantra, which is much of what Vajrayana is, in the path of Buddhist Tantra, it is the inseparability of compassion and wisdom that is your landing point, if you like, your result, the experience that comes from the transformative process, and there's a lot more in Vajrayana as well that maybe we could come to later, but just by way of that contrast that you brought between Sutra and Tantra, there's I'm going to say there's a relationship between them that becomes really important, that is about coming into presence and spaciousness, like finding confidence in the not known, the unknown, the spaciousness of our possibility. Yeah, the spaciousness of being here in a body different from others. And that's kind of the starting point.
There's many things bubbling up. I just wonder what you think about this. We've talked on the podcast about this shift from a self-improvement paradigm to, you know, an unfolding paradigm, a poetic attunement, which feels very resonant with what you're talking about, particularly like in the, you know, the self-improvement, which can have its place, you know, if you're wanting to learn a skill like a language. But when it comes to, you know, working with the self in context, can perpetuate a sense that there's something missing, because it starts with a premise that, you know, I'm not okay where I am, but where I, over there in the future, if I can get to that place, then I'll be okay. And I think, you know, a lot of coaching kind of can be based in that paradigm. And it doesn't negate that we have desires and dreams and things, but it's kind of working this unfolding paradigm. And I'm, you know, credit to Steve March, kind of influenced me a lot here. It's like working much more with like what's here now, mm-hmm. you know, the presence of the what, like in presencing what's here, mm-hmm. working with embodied experience. And on top of that, I think, again, coming back to what I said, where a lot of what I inherited around coaching and leadership was this kind of like atomized view of a leader, you know, separate from everything, like individual. But it seems now that there's also a movement in coaching where it's like we're coaching the relationship between things, mm-hmm. as being at least as important than the things themselves, if not more primary, you know? And so, yeah, I wonder if that feels like they resonate with the view you're talking about.
It certainly does, yeah. And the coaching relationship itself as being the vehicle through which transformation occurs. And that's very much coming from a Vajrayana, traditional Vajrayana paradigm, and yet changing the nature of the roles. So having the relationship still be where the transformation happens and how the transformation happens, and yet there's less rigidity, less fixity in terms of the absolute nature of the roles. There's much more possibility for fluidity there. You know, as you were talking about the progressive success-oriented drive towards this always future perfect state of being. I was making a connection between the Buddhist approaches, and I don't want to simply keep those being sutra. There's a lot of that in Tantra as well, and in Vajrayana, it still comes up. It's much more to do with you know, different lineages or paths that have that kind of forward leaning approach, and we have that in our business training, in our strategy, in our leadership training as well. I think the way that I've come to understand the relationship between those two attitudes, because they seem to be incompossible, don't they? They seem to be like you cannot have this and this at the same time. And I think in some senses that is true. And what I feel happens differently is that once somebody is fully present and able to be in their body. And a lot of the work is, to begin with, is finding what that experience is like, because it's freaking revelatory sometimes. I mean, it can be all kinds of things. It could be explosive. It can be absolutely extraordinary, like your body coming alive over a period of 6 months, a year, a couple of years, when you've lived in your head the entirety of your life, like actually experiencing that, oh, there is a responsiveness here. There's a signal, there's data that I haven't even been in connection with. When that happens, something changes about the way that we hold goals and the way that we create projects and do stuff in the world, and the way that we have effect, the way that we're efficient or make things and build things. Something utterly, totally changes, and there's a kind of confidence and willingness to pivot, to change, to move with what is emerging, to bring in new things, to be in that co-creative process. Not saying that there isn't a goal, but that it's held so much more loosely. It's not the mapping and the guiding feature. It's more like it facilitates direction. That's a very, very different experience, being in that process with people, than being driven to an external map. Is that making sense?
It does, totally. I think this is where, like, complexity theory as well. You know, we've had people like Dave Snowden on the podcast who, you know, he's a very kind of contrarian voice, but I've learned a lot from him, you know, because I didn't really like what he was saying when I first met him. You know, people like that, I always want to listen to them more. It sounds like when you're talking in this way, there's like the goal is something, a place to live from, in a sense. Like it creates a sense of direction, but you're not falling into some of those traps that you can get where you have a kind of limited narrowing of a view and you exclude a lot of other possibilities or perception or phenomena. So there's a kind of more openness and easefulness or generativity with that goal.
I want to bring an example. Actually, I'm thinking of an example that is very, very recent in my coaching. And it's a slightly unusual example too, because very often in my coaching practice, there's where we end is a very specific method geared to that person's context and relationships and experience that they can take and experiment with. Very often those are coming from Vajrayana, not always, sometimes from other traditions, developmental or gestalt or whatever. But this example that I was thinking of, I love the conversation that I have with my clients. I mean, they light me up, seriously. I just feel very often I'll finish a call and we'll both be like in this new exploratory space of what could be possible for them in their lives. And I finished a call very recently and we'd been talking about how the nature of the problem that scientists and particularly computer scientists are working with now is changing, like the type, the nature of the problem. And I'm, you know, I'm putting that word in inverted commas, but for decades now, there's been a very particular sort of functional issue that scientists have been grappling with. A lot of that is now sorted in some way by AI, and yet a new meta kind of problem emerges, and it's to do with human AI guidance and relationship and facilitating an AI to be able to, an agent to be able to describe when it gets to a particular point of stuckness or looping, and to do that in a way that is very context dependent and relevant to the work of the researcher. So we were having this conversation. It was so interesting. And by the end of the conversation, I suggested or invited a paper like, oh, I would love to read about that whole process and how you might discover and make that possible for other people. And so something like that came from the conversation. And I've been going on enough that I've forgotten where we started with that. But
what role in the conversation is like plays like passion and because you know that it sounds like through that conversation you both came to this kind of sense of wow, like we could create this, you know. Mm. What if we had this in relationship to this challenge, you know? So is it that you're orienting around like creativity and passion and what might want to happen in response?
Very often. Yeah, very often it is. But I think that comes out of the initial work, which is the relational, the often the developmental work as well. Like there's a very common, I think it would be called décalage or lag in the developmental psychological world, whereby for scientists and engineers, being in a systematic or meta-systematic relationship with their work or with the world cognitively, like in their conceptual capacity, is easy. That's, you know, the world that they live in. And emotionally, there's a lag or a lack of familiarity in being able to relate from that experience, the emotional experience, the embodied experience, and to be able to do that with confidence, with connection and separateness, with seeing old patterns and finding something new and different. And a lot of the work that I do with my community of practice is in that area of seeing our patterns of interaction and coming to really be quite familiar with them, not as habituated loops, but as possibilities for change and transformation.
Yeah. I love this great you go here, because this is a place I wanted to speak to you about. Could you say more about how you see working with those patterns? Because I think, you know, when I think of transformational coaching or developmental coaching, it, you know, this is one of the key areas, is like where we start to notice, you know, what we're subject to, that it can become an object in our awareness, or we start to see these patterns. And I wonder how that works for you, and the role of emotions in that, in terms of also, you know, you've got one view, which is quite common, which is like maybe a more therapeutic, you know, view of like there's an integration that can take place, you know, when one begins to relate to one's emotions and the patterning, you know, it can begin to relax and open up and it goes away. And then maybe, you know, I don't know how you see this, but sometimes Vajrayana, maybe it's like, it's not taking a healing view, is it? Is it just working with it as energy? Anyway, could you I said enough there.
And Vajrayana would not, many people understand and work in Vajrayana with a healing modality. So that is coming much more from a psychological perspective and merging the two. It doesn't have to be that there is a healing modality. Very often there's a awakening perspective or an awareness, like finding awareness in habitual patterns. And yeah, that comes into Vajrayana as much as it does to psychology. But often the end point is described as different. I feel like I'm getting a little bit theoretical here. I want to bring it back to practice. We, as children, we create these extraordinary ways of being that are kind of inherited. They're inherited, they're the way that we survive in the world. They're kind of beautiful, safe, reassuring, familiar. And a lot of the work, I feel, a lot of the connection between what we do with spiritual methodology or what we bring to coaching from developmental experience training is in being able to actually experience ourselves doing that thing. Like seeing that, I mean, seeing in the broadest sense, like experiencing that, I'm doing that thing again. And having some compassion towards that, some self-love, recognition. It's not that those patterns are bad. They're not. They have kept us alive. So there's some sense in which we can really experience the like being on our edge. At our like Jennifer Garvey Berger would say, the growth edge of our experience, being in that with another being, that can be utterly, utterly transformative. Yeah, so I think the connection between the Vajrayana approach and the developmental approach is in how are we with these patterns? How do we find them and stay with them despite the discomfort and find space enough that we can change?
Yeah. It seems like when you're with your clients, you said their embodied experience is an important doorway into those patterns. So I'm imagining you help them to kind of sense what arises in relationship to the topic they bring in. And that's a key part of it.
It is. And it's, I might energetically might say that it is to do with how those patterns resonate in the subtle body. So that sounds like a bit of a jargony phrase. I'll unpack that a little bit so that it's more understood in a felt sense. So in the psychological approach, we understand these patterns, we understand them through communication. Like, for example, I experienced threat as a child. I experienced the world as big, as overwhelming. So therefore, I have to armor myself, protect myself. And I can put those patterns into, like, I can describe them with words. And that's incredibly valuable. It's in the realm of interpretation. And understanding our patterns through interpretation can be really, really useful. Vajrayana brings an experience of what those patterns are like as knots, entanglements, visceral knots in the body, like literally in my heart, in my solar plexus. Like if I'm able to slow and find presence enough with what is happening underneath all of that interactive pull, push, hooking and prodding and all of that, if I can find what is happening really quite deeply inside of my central body, then it's possible to change the experience of those from the inside out, and have experiences of untangling that then affect the way that I am in communication in a quite extraordinary way. Like I can see how some experience that is a pattern was held in my body, and as that loosens out, also the way that I relate with you and with others begins to have more possibilities. There's more in the possibility space there. So there's this connection between how we hold our communication and how we understand it and interpret it as well.
Yeah, I get, like, this is where I get really excited, because I think this for me is like so potent, you know, when we start to work on this level that you're describing, because it's very practical and yet subtle. And it's like honoring that these patterns are even doorways, or, you know, invitations to, you know, to bring into awareness in the way you're describing. And I've had experiences where just including embracing some kind of knot or contraction without a goal, you know, this is the tricky part, without a goal to get somewhere to, you know, but it's kind of like opened into, you know, a feeling of great kind of spaciousness and well-being, and, you know, that then kind of lasts. And, you know, I think, I wonder how you see this, that, you know, as AI comes in more, I think one of the questions everyone's asking amongst the many we're asking is like, well, who are we really as human beings? You know, we've got these AI entities, and there's a kind of, they do this stuff, and we call them intelligent, and they are in many ways. And yet we're very different. And I think therefore a lot of coaches are now being invited to ask, well, what is the work of coaching that AI won't take, at least not that I see, you know, in the kind of next few years. And I think it's this realm of subtle work, and of like the liberation of energy, and in service of agency, of in service of expression and aliveness. What that brings up for you, if anything.
Yeah. Well, and present. Like a moment of presence between two beings in the world.
Yeah. I mean, I feel that now as you name that, and there's just a sense of joy, you know, right. that comes in there and yeah. an intimacy and like goodness.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. And I wanted to ask you as well, like we're talking about the experience in the body, like the actual visceral, the experience of sensation moving, like moving through our heart, our solar plexus, our gut, like into our throat, all the way through into our pelvis, our head, everywhere. You know, we feel sensation moving in and around the body. And we were talking about interpretation and patterns, and you brought your experience. And I was just really curious whether you had noticed a difference in your relationships as well and in your interactions as a result of those two coming together.
I mean, just night and day, really.
Right.
It's like, right. I mean, it's kind of difficult to know where to start, really, in terms of there's just like the love I feel for my family, you know, this simple love and joy, like the kind of radiance of my family. It's just like exquisite, you know, and I think in some ways it's the inverse of like what motivated my spiritual practice in the early days, which like I just felt scared and unsafe, you know, and I wanted to understandably like solve that or get away from it. But the shift in my practice was what actually allowed for the real sense of intimacy and groundedness and openness that I was looking for. So yeah, there's like there's more freedom of expression, mm-hmm. like less, it's like paradoxically caring more or feeling more, but caring less and feeling more lighthearted. And I think this is, yeah, another word which has become really important to me. And I remember you speaking about this, but enjoyment,
yeah,
you know, like enjoyment, like the inherent, like irreducible enjoyment of being with others in life and doing good things. You know, it's like, like, well, great. So I remember saying to you, I love being me. I love being me. And you were like, yeah. Fantastic. You just smiled. And because, you know, that wasn't, I was wrestling with all of that, you know, there's a lot of the sutric stuff is like, you know, you don't exist. And this is the last thing I'll say, but I remember, his name's going to escape me now. I'm quoting him quite a lot because he was a non-dual teacher who rejected the more transcendent non-duality. Because he said, like, would I tell my daughter you don't exist? Would I tell my you know, 5-year-old daughter you don't exist? Or, you know, thoughts are an illusion? No, I wouldn't. So why would I tell myself that? You know.
Yeah. The self is incredibly welcome in Tantra, like incredibly important. Like we need and invite selves and selving in order to get stuff done in the world. There's this orientation towards fluidity. Fluidity of being, and the self is not problematized at all, really. It's rigidity and fixing of identity that can be problematic, I think. So having more of a range and a nuanced understanding of what it even means to be selfing in the world is more where we're at in our practice. And you said about enjoyment, all of the emotions are so welcome it's the relationship with and how we relate with our emotional texture of being that is important, and including the discomfort. The only way fully to experience the opening, the joy and the opening in the heart center, is through being with all of the discomfort or the differences, the knots that have been formed by that habitual and yet creative way of being in the world. So enjoyment, yeah, is really important in my coaching, in our practice. Yeah, meditating can be enjoyable, for sure.
Something you just said brings up a question. Do you help your clients to land in new ways of being that they then experiment with? Is that something you might do? Is it more just like liberating so spontaneous ways of being can arise, or might you kind of practice particular flavors?
I think, you know, there are different paradigms for coaching and what we do, how we are as coaches, and I feel like what happens is that emergence from the coaching conversation is where the fruits come about, and it can take a lot of practice, myself and with a client, to get to the point where we're actually in conversation, like a conversation. Like what is a conversation? It is a shared presence. It's a shared interactive presence of awareness, such that we're confident enough in not knowing what is going to come about from this. We're relaxed enough in our being that we can just we can land, be together here, and then see what is there, what is really mattering in the moment, and then from that place come into some kind of exploration of what is needed in this difficult situation, this difficult relational situation that is being brought into the conversation. Let's explore, let's simulate that experience here in the coaching relationship, and let's see what arises from that. And let's do that with awareness and with presence, such that something is going to present itself as a possibility for practice. Very often that's where we end up. It's a possibility for practice. I want to make this concrete and bring an example. So simple. Often it's very, very simple. Like, noticing, how about every time I notice that I'm feeling this slight anxiety, this sort of fizzy thing here in my chest, I stop speaking. How about that as a practice? Now, what is it like to stop speaking? Just like that. Really simple, simple practices that that come out from conversation.
The sense of that you're interrupting that habit or that pattern, and then seeing what happens as you do that.
Mm-hmm. Trying something different. Yeah. And there are literally hundreds, possibly thousands of very personal prompts or practices for interaction, for relation, that come out from conversation.
I love how you describe that that the transformation is in the conversation itself. You know, that's the territory and the practice. And I want to ask you about those practices you named. I know you said there's hundreds, and so I'd love to get a sense of them. But you already said this in a way, like that something meaningful arises and then a kind of response to the challenge that someone could practice. Like, I don't know if this is a question you can even answer really, but what are you tracking moment to moment in the conversation as you're in dialogue? Now, I mean, I guess that could be many, many things, but yeah. How do you know you're on the right track? Like if you're in the unknown, you know, what guides you?
I don't know, Joel, honestly. You know, it's like you know when it's there. You know what I mean? Like there's a mutual pair and interest and engagement such that we're both involved, really involved in the content and able to be present and stand back and wait for the question to arise. You know, sometimes it's just utterly, utterly extraordinary. The sense of I think the word that comes to mind is revelation, and I feel a little cautious in using that word because it has so many historical and connotations or means different things to different people. But you know, there's sometimes there's a moment we've been able to drop into that sense of being right here. There's a moment of realization. Oh, that's what has been holding me. That's what's been gripping me here in this experience.
Yeah. Do you find I can relate to what you're sharing very much? And sometimes it's like you just drop into a kind of almost like a flow state where the conversation is unfolding at the pace of itself, you know, and insight, revelation is very kind of available, and you're inside the livingness of the conversation itself, and that itself is transformative. It's not that you need to. I mean, you can do practices, but it's like you said, that the transformation is unfolding here right now in conversation.
I think it happens through questions, actually. Yeah, it's the nature of the questions. There's an integrity. There's a care, And then the questions arise from that conversation. Yeah. You know, I feel like a conversation isn't a conversation unless it's possible that something can emerge that wasn't known before. And then as you, you know, with a client, over time, there becomes this kind of richness, this tapestry of shared context and conversations. I have a client, my very first client in a coaching context, Sasha. And Sasha has been writing on Substack, so he's public about his practice as well. And, you know, we've been in conversation now for, well, 6 years on a pretty much a weekly basis. I'm aware that for many coaches, there'd be a sort of a response that might be a, shouldn't we have a container, a short container with goals? And yeah, maybe sometimes, but the depth and the richness and the growth that has occurred from that continued and continuing conversation is extraordinary. I feel humbled by the learning in that. You know, I have a facilitatory role, and when we started out, I was very much a mentor, you know, meditation coach, and a Vajrayana, bringing the Vajrayana perspective, and you know, very different roles than the roles that we have now through the care, the awareness, the attention over years. Something shifts and becomes possible, such that the nature of the relationship now has exploded out of the coaching container, and that's fine. That's fine. We're in conversation, and there's a very natural result here now. There's a mutuality and a shared respect that has come from the coaching. Is now becoming available for others through podcasts and through recorded conversations that we've had.
What I find striking about that is that, and it's a question really, but I kind of hear you saying it, which is that, okay, the coaching client role structure has its certain value and place, but there's also this place where you break free from that, and maybe there's a mutual inquiry. And I think that's actually there's a mutual transformation inside of a coach-client relationship too. But maybe that even beyond that, there's even more liberated, and that, you know, it's now like a kind of developmental friendship, or maybe friendship's not the right word, but it's like a, you know, transformational connection. And
there's a mutuality there, and I think you can't force that as well. It just occurs naturally over time, and
I'd love to tee this up, and it maybe we do a part two, but you know, we haven't talked, we've named developmental, the developmental perspective, but could you say how that kind of complemented the Vajrayana view for you? Like it seems, I get the sense for you, they fit together well, and or it's the two have enhanced the work you do.
Yeah, could you say I think so. How? Yeah, I do think so. Like, you know, personally, leaving traditional Vajrayana was a developmental move. Myself, I relate that to being a part of my own developmental change and transformation. And it wasn't easy to leave that context, to leave the security of the you know, the many years in that place. But through the process itself and through coming to understand that process and then taking that into my own coach training in you know, in the Keegan systems and adult development psychology, understanding my own process and change, change individuation itself, that I think, you know, that I don't know what I'm saying exactly, but that came to be very important in terms of my exploring with my clients what is happening for them in their relationships and their processes as well. Is there a question in there?
Yeah. I'm guessing, and this might maybe take a little unpacking for a few of the listeners in terms of what developmental psychology is. Mm-hmm. And I think many know it. We've had Robert Keegan on the podcast and others in the field, but are you saying that, you know, to use these technical terms, like, was it like there was a socialization within the lineage and it kind of allowed you to even move into like a kind of post, you know, a systemic post-systemic view of like, how do I relate to this through my own world?
Exactly that. The lineage experience, the context that was the world that I swam in, became object, that became through my separation from that, that became, and that for me was quite a socialized context. And the cognitive dissonance in that was the agency, the self-authorship. And as I moved more into my own agency from that context, with appreciation, but also with resistance to, and a felt sense of personal need to move into a more fluid, wider context. So that process occurring became of interest to me in terms of like, what even is that? What's happening? Now, when I read Robert Keegan's Evolving Self book, that had a huge, huge influence on me. Like, I could see my own process in that. Like, oh, just it brought a framework that helped me understand what was happening in terms of my my own process into agency. And into being an organized system myself, and then moving beyond.
And about, you know, self-transforming form of mind and Vajrayana, it seems like there could be some complements there. But I just want to throw something in and see something I've been playing with, which is kind of connects to what we talked about earlier, where I kind of imbibed the developmental theory, and it kind of in some sense like propagated a, you know, a separate sense of self, like that was disconnected, you know. And so I opened to the idea of, and I'm playing with this, I'm not sure if it's true or not. I mean, maybe it doesn't matter, maybe it's more interesting if it's useful, but through people like Dave Snowden, who've challenge developmental models in a way that enrich my learning of them. Is it like context, you know, what comes first? Like, is it my form of mind, you know, which constructs the world? Or is there a equal force of like the context of the world, you know, brings about the arising of a certain maturity of self? I've been in spaces, like, for example, I, you know, in my family life, sometimes I can find myself, you know, reacting, contracting. And then in certain collective spaces, I've noticed it's like the when it works well, it's like the whole group kind of starts to access mm-hmm. a very metacognitive, like embodied, you know, not just like self-transforming kind of space where we're all mutually, you know, co-arising and still individual, but, you know, self-transforming. That's a very good word for it. Like, and so, yeah, I don't know if that question makes sense, like, and even if it's of interest to you, but it's been of an interest to me.
The context or the form of mind, and I feel like the context is going to, I'm not sure I like the word trigger exactly, but there's a context gives rise to certain patterns. And if we're in a particularly, if I'm in a particularly challenging, for me, context that, you know, really kind of pulls me from presence or from awareness into an old pattern, then that happens. And then I am in that context more in what in the growth edge coaching would be called your trailing edge. You know, we have a center of gravity, and then we have a growth edge, and we have a trailing edge. I feel like, you know, in many different contexts, there are, let's take the Vajrayana context, you could be, people could be in the same context and yet in a very different place with regards to their form of mind or the way that context plays itself out. And at the same time, it tends to be that we have these kind of attractor groupings where it tends to be that the norm in that group context is going to be one of a particular kind, a particular sort of interaction, and the norm in another group context will be somewhat different. I've put a lot of thought and creativity with people in Evolving Ground in the community into this question that we've been sitting in. How do we know that we can create, or how do we know that we are creating interactive group dynamics that are mutually growthful and transformative, and that are providing a vehicle for anybody who comes into that context to have the space and both the support and the challenge that that we meet them wherever we meet our community members, wherever we're at, and to the extent that they want change and transformation and movement into another form of mind, that is possible. So there's a lot of interrelation between the developmental models and Vajrayana within that community space.
What is important for that, do you think? I mean, it's probably a nuanced answer, but yeah, what do you find are the conditions that are supportive for that mutual transformation?
Skillful disagreement is one. It's really important to be able to disagree and learn how to disagree skillfully and confidently and in a way that isn't necessarily aggressive or rebellious, or, you know, it's just simply skillful disagreement. It's okay to be different and to have different perspectives and to explore that. It's interesting. It could be frictious. That's okay. Yeah, it could be a lot of tension there. That's fine. So welcoming conflict very definitely is part of that growth process. You know, I don't believe in my self as a human being, that it is possible to live in a world where there is not conflict. As soon as we have difference, then the potential for conflict is there, and we love difference. So skillful disagreement is one. Curious skepticism, like, you know, both parts of that are so, so important. Curiosity is the openness aspect, it's the spacious aspect, it's the connected, remaining in connection. And then the skepticism is not just taking things for granted, but actually wondering and exploring and challenging and being in not knowing, being totally okay, learning how to be okay with not knowing. And noticing doubt, noticing when in a group context, when there's, you know, maybe some kind of energetic pressure, social pressure, like I feel that in my body. I feel the pressure to be a certain way or conform a certain way, like noticing what is that like when that occurs in my body as the site of pressure from outside, external demand to, you know, make myself a certain way according to what is happening out there.
Mm-hmm.
So that's very different from fluid interaction that occurs in awareness, I think.
It strikes me that that would keep a group, how could I put it, like it would stop it becoming kind of too, I don't know, same. Mm-hmm. Sameness doesn't kind of coagulate and even, you know, become cult-like, where it's like, you know, not in the strong sense of the word, but like, you know, we're all now socialized into this is who we are, and that can be nice maybe, but it's not necessarily a mutually transformative space. Then it's like, yeah, it's become, you know, formed around a particular set of free beliefs or ways of being. So right, yeah,
right. And yeah, the norms of interaction are where that happens, I think. Like if you go into any group at all and you simply notice what are the conventions of communication here, what's actually happening and repeating itself in the patterns, what is it like? Yeah,
I'm aware of our time as well.
Yeah. Yeah, thank you for pointing to that.
Do you have another minute or do you have a hard stop?
I do. Yeah.
I mean, I feel like there's a lot we could say about what you just shared, but I wonder, you know, I do want to ask you where we can find out more about your work. But I wonder if there's anything you want to share just in closing that yeah, no need to, but there's anything here.
I was in preparation for having a conversation with you, Joel. I was just awed by the resource that you've created here in this podcast. The hundreds. I mean, you have hundreds of conversations. What a gift. I mean, that it's wonderful. So I want to appreciate the work, the joy that you've brought here, all of this resource that you've created. And in that, it struck me how, you know, the consistency of doing this, of being here for this again and again and again, and just, you know, the keeping it going. That in itself is what makes a big difference, like the continuity of what you have here. So yeah, massive appreciation for all of those conversations, for all that you're doing here with Coaches Rising. Yeah.
Thank you. Yeah. It's been a transformative practice, actually, you know, to be in conversation with amazing people, but also to take on the perspectives, you know, and follow my curiosity. There's many of the things you've discussed, actually, you've been, you know, part of doing this. So, I mean, hey, Charlie, I just really enjoy being with you. And I want to say that I'm struck by how you've embodied in our conversation many of the things you're talking about, you know, like a relatedness and a curiosity, a spontaneity, that sense of being in the conversation, you know, like as you, that's it. That's what it felt like to me. It's like we're in the conversation, the real conversation. So thank you. And yeah, where can we find out more about your work and stuff?
Sure. Yeah, spaciousclarity.com. That is the place that I'll be. So we're putting courses out there. There'll be opportunity for people to be the first to test out the opening awareness course there. That'll be fun. And yeah, there'll be things you can sign up for. So spaciousclarity.com.
Thanks for tuning into the podcast. I really hope you enjoyed it. And a reminder that the early bird enrollment is now open for our upcoming live training with Jim Dethmer and Bob Anderson. It's called Unlocking Leaders, and it's going to teach you how to coach at the level of consciousness, which is for me the highest leverage move you can make as a coach. Your client's consciousness is the place where the deepest, truest transformational breakthroughs come from. And often traditional coaching misses this. And it's something that our clients need us to learn as coaches. Because our times are calling for something deeper. We've got to go beneath the content of our experience, beneath strategy, to the source of change. And that's exactly what Unlocking Leaders is designed to teach you. I'm so proud of this program, of what it's become. I feel it's our offering in these times. And if you're ready to answer the call of these times, then you can join the full program. So just head to coachesrising.com/leaders to book your spot. And remember, you can get the early bird discount if you join by 29th of May. Here we are. We're at the end of the podcast. Just a heads up again, if you're not on our mailing list and you want to stay in the loop about other things we create, then head to coachesrising.com. Put your name in the sign up box there. You'll also find some of our other offerings, our online trainings for coaches there. And just want to end by wishing you well, and I'll see you again next time.